daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. Coming up, Chinese officials have defended a realistic GDP target for 2024 while vowing to crack down upon financial markets' irregularities. We will take a look at an Australia-hosted ASEAN summit. Germany and Russia have sparred over a leaked audio regarding missiles for Ukraine. And Apple gets fined by nearly $2 billion by the European Union for hindering music streaming competition. To listen to this episode again, which you catch upon on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. China says its plan to issue ultra-long special government bonds will help shore up investment and consumption, laying the foundation for long-term high-quality development. Zheng Shanjie, with the National Development and Reform Commission, says the funds raised through these bonds will support innovation, integrated urban-rural development, food and energy security, among others. China plans to issue the special government bonds starting from this year and over the coming few years. The head of China's National Economic Planning Agency made the remark on Wednesday as part of a press conference regarding economic work at the annual gathering of the country's National People's Congress. The press conference was also joined by the heads from the Finance Ministry, Commerce Ministry, Central Bank, and the Securities Regulatory Commission. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. Thank you very much for joining us. So as we heard from Zheng Shanjie, the head of the National Development and Reform Commission, he said during this Wednesday afternoon press conference that China's economy is likely to face more favorable conditions than headwinds or challenges over the course of 2024, and he has cited a more solid development foundation as well as more proactive micro policies like fiscal policy or monetary policy. So would you share this optimism?
Yeah, I think I agree with him in this this topic. When we're talking about China's development for the economy, we have to understand that there are two elements. The first one is the conditions about what we are now. I think that maybe in the past last year we see so many uncertainties, and that year is the term we just transformed from the COVID-19 related status to a new one. So it's a year of a recovery. To return to the normal track. Well, this year we see there are still so many uncertainty, but we know that the trend is a little bit more certain. So in this regard, we are trying to cooperate with different resources to build on this certainty and trying to have a better, to coordination with different parties. I think that is much more favorable compared with last year.
Okay. So as we can tell from Premier Li Qiang's Tuesday government work report, policymakers' vision for the Chinese economy in 2024 is probably to transform China's economic model further while at the same time keeping the economic growth rate somewhat steady. So do you think these two things, these two particular agenda, can be achieved or pushed ahead with at the same time?
As people may always believe that when we are trying to develop in a much quicker speed, we may sacrifice for the quality. But it is in the past. I don't think that we are still trying to follow that trend because, the situation has changed a lot and the people are really want to get benefited by the quality. The quality of development of the economy and also the trade. So we have put that on the first position compared with the speed. Well, it's still in the degree we're discussing about the status. When the high quality has become a trend, I think that it will bring even stronger speed of growth. So we were trying to talk about these two agendas. I do believe that they can be coordinated. Well, for the more priority one, I think that higher quality would be the better one. if we want to try to have stronger and more sustainable development, I think that we need to understand the nature of development and trying to make better use of the resources. And that is really depending on the nowadays situation.
So more specifically, with regard to this ultra-long-term special government bonds that China plans to issue starting from this year and over the course of the following 2 years, what do you think can be done to ensure that these bonds will really, end up helping shore up investments in say, consumption, something that this top NDRC official has promised?
Yeah, China is not in a very heavy debt, generally, but we're still trying to use this bond to have a better impact on the expectation of the market. The expectation of the market is even more important than the money. So if we have issued this bond, I think that it's giving some very steady signal that the market is trying to follow the track for a little bit longer term. So in this regard, I think that they have a special target and also the ways of using this money collected from this bond. And these are definitely on some higher quality development, like the new infrastructure and also something to do to boost the new consumption and trying to make the investors believe that we have a better environment. So I believe that is a kind of thing to combine with the different measures. And the important thing of that is the confidence.
Okay, confidence. So you gave some definitions, say, new infrastructure and a new consumption. So in your understanding, what do you think would distinguish a new infrastructure, for example, from the old way of building infrastructure?
New infrastructure is mainly something that is more adaptable to the, the new trend of development, like something to do with the digital economy, and also trying to put better support of the people who can consume in the, in the internet and within that platform. It can give us more support on the a better integration of the industries and to make it more automatically handled even from far away. But I mean that new infrastructure is kind of things that is always we're trying to have more definition and the range of the meanings, but we need to take care of that according to the the change of the supply chain and also the industrial development.
So Dr. Zhou Mi, because this press conference on Wednesday afternoon we are talking about here, because this event involved the top officials from a number of different economic and financial work, government departments or agencies or ministries. So with that in mind, how would you rate the importance of, say, intergovernmental policy coordination in terms of ensuring a healthy economy for China over the course of 2024?
Yeah, it's really important because, the functions even for the different ministries or departments are changing according to the situation. So we are in the world of changing. So we have to adapt ourselves to trying to better coordinate in between the government. The government is one of the important elements of the economy, but it's not only the element. So we need to consider about the new functions, new requirements, and the new, the rules that can be affect. Very important to the decision of the investors. But I believe that, no matter from the industrial sectors, the ministries, or from the sectional sectors and industries, they should try to listen to others and also listen to the market, of Chinese investors and also from FDIs. It is a kind of, an integration of different functions and trying to make a better and a better support for the market to have a better function.
Okay, your point's well taken. So Wednesday's press conference actually saw these different top officials address really different economic issues or financial issues ranging from hidden debts. That's the question addressed by the finance minister and urbanization. That's addressed by another minister, I guess, on a part of the central bank governor. He has addressed about whether or not PBOC will work with the United States over the course of 2024. And then we are talking about, say, issues like stock market problems, stock market regulations. So which particular issue has really drawn your attention the most?
Yeah, I mean that all these things are real big topics, and they are really some kind of things we have to take in very care of. But in my understanding, I think the urbanization is one of the priorities because Chinese market is developing, and the urbanization is trying to change the scenarios between the different cities and even city clusters. So this is a fundamental, you know, ways for us to develop the market, the consumption market, also the investment market. And I believe that we can try to better urbanize our, you know, economy to have, you know, support more opportunities for the different stakeholders.
So, of course, Chinese Premier Li Qiang on Tuesday struck a overall, you know, positive tone about the Chinese economy in his government work report, noting that the upward fundamentals with regard to the Chinese economy are really remaining unchanged. But in the meantime, he also acknowledged that there were many lingering risks for the Chinese economy. So what do you think? Could you put your fingers on these so-called lingering risks?
Yeah, the risks are always there. And, you know, from last year, there are more geopolitical risks. And these are really, you know, something to change the ways that people cooperate with each other. And they also impose many of the threats for the, you know, for the ongoing trade and investment. People may think that the trade will becoming more expensive, so they have to prepare more. I mean, to put more in the stock, and that will also change the thing that we can buy from the market. Well, the other one I would think is you know, some protectionism and unilateralism. They are really changing the rules of the trade and investment. So in the past, people believe that we have promised and we have, you know, the agreement. But sometimes if they do not believe that this is still the rules that's keeping the activities on, they may think about why should we stick to them. So if there are more of them are trying to disobey or do not fulfill their commitments, the world will be in chaos. So I do believe that these are two risks. And the third one is about the innovative ways of development. The digital economy, artificial intelligence, they are really changing the patterns of the, you know, stakeholders' relations. So these are really challenging for all the stakeholders too. They have to adapt to that, and there are more rooms that we can explore.
So in other words, there are risks, lingering risks coming from both inside and outside of China. And yeah, and it's really difficult to pinpoint which risks is bigger, but there are all risks. Now, you talk about, say, innovation when you were addressing my last question. And I guess when we talk about innovation, there is a popular term nowadays being emphasized by the Chinese government, new quality productive forces. Now, regarding, say, employment over the course of this year, Chinese government plans to create somewhere around 12 million urban jobs this year. So to what extent do you think this new quality productive forces could help achieve this goal in terms of job creation?
Yeah, it's a really our thing that we have to address because, you know, the world is changing. Many countries are developing their, you know, artificial intelligence and more innovative ways of development. If you cannot catch up with them, I think that China will be left behind. So it's really important for us also to try to catch up with them. And even in some sectors, we should lead the ways of development. So how can we achieve that? It cannot be, you know, automatically happened. We have to support the, you know, the people to do that. So in this regard, we have to, you know, to expand the market for supplying this kind of new jobs which are related to these new areas. That's what China was still in the ways of trying to balance between different regions. And the better way for us to have a, you know, sustainable way of development is not just trying to follow what we have experienced for decades. We should try to find the better ways to reduce the impact on the environment and also create more opportunities to not only for Chinese people, but for the partners with us. That's you know, the meaning of the what the human the common world in the in this degree, and I believe that will provide so many rooms.
Okay, thank you very much. That was Dr. Zhou Mi. You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. A Hong Kong business leader calls for improving the city's financial regulatory mechanism in light of increasing geopolitical uncertainties. Vincent Lee, a member of the CPPCC National Committee and a chairman of Dongtai Group of Companies, proposed a bill to safeguard Hong Kong's financial security at this year's ongoing two sessions. And during an interview with my colleague Xu Yawen, Mr. Lee also said that Hong Kong has a very unique advantage regarding one country, two systems.
China set the GDP growth target at around 5% in Premier Li's government work report, the same as last year. What signal does it convey?
Well, first of all, there's a Western saying, you can't keep a good man down, no matter how hard you try. Despite last year's adversity, we still achieved a 5.2. So this year, we're expecting about 5%, which is very good compared to other countries around the world at the present time. You know, the Chinese people are very resilient to adversity. What other country in the world, you have a think tank of over 5,000 people? If you think about it, we have close to 3,000 NPC and over 2,000 CPCC from all walks of life, all different industry, different level, all having one goal, one objective, is to improve the lives of the Chinese people. Not only that, our culture and our philosophy of common prosperity, meaning not robbing the rich and giving to the poor, but to share if we all work very hard, which is very different from the philosophy of winner takes all. So our philosophy is towards peace, common prosperity, not only for the overall good of the Chinese people, for our neighbors, for the world. So that is a strong magic to the world. If you look at also the numbers, electric car, we are reducing about 60% of the world's production. What does that tell you? That we are very serious about green energy. We are very serious about better education, improving the lives of the elderly. Very serious about agricultural, very serious about technologies and innovation. Overall, you look at the numbers, we are serious. All having one common goal, the betterment of the lives of people in China and for our neighbors.
I want to focus on the integration development between Hong Kong and the Chinese mainland, because we know over the past few decades there have been significant achievements in this area, especially in the finance sector. So now with further opening up of the national financial services sector, what other areas can be expanded between Hong Kong and mainland in the future? And how will these further enhance Hong Kong's competitiveness as an international financial center?
Well, as you know, I was the independent director for the Hong Kong exchanges for 17 years. So during that time, we have also developed the stock connects, and also we're actually trying to do the bond connects. And in the southern China, the Greater Bay Area, we're doing a lot to integrate the 11 cities. Now, in the coming future, there's so many things that we can do in terms of offshore RMB, in terms of RMB bonds, center offshore, and furthermore, most important, offshore RMB digital currency. Hopefully, that could be that in Hong Kong. So in terms of other, for example, green financing, innovative, creative fundraising, there's a tremendous amount of things that we can do to connect the two places. After all, Hong Kong is the only international financial center for China. Shanghai, Shenzhen, and see, but truly international is Hong Kong. So facing the world, Hong Kong plays a very important role in the financial arena for China.
Recently, we do have noticed that Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index has been weakening. And in Premier Li's government work report, he mentioned that the central government will support Hong Kong and Macau to grow their economies and maintain long-term prosperity and stability. In the meantime, Hong Kong's Finance Secretary Paul Chen also said that in order to further enhance market efficiency and liquidity, Hong Kong Stock Exchange are exploring a series of measures, including improving the listing mechanism and optimizing trading mechanism. So how will these measures help to boost Hong Kong's capital market and attract international investment?
First of all, the market is down for a number of external reasons as well. You know, overall macro and trade relationship and high interest rates. But in reality, if you look at the companies, they are really good values right now. Low PE, high dividend yields. A lot of listed companies, the price is actually below NAV. So the potential for investment is great right now. Of course, there's some lack of confidence by investors this time due to a lot of spreading of false rumors by Western media and so on. Now, we need to restore confidence, which could be done very quickly. And recently, Paul Chen announced a number of measures, and if some of these, all of these, could be put in place, we can see great significance rise in liquidity and the liquidity of price discovery and much better market. So potential is there. I'm very confident the stock market for Hong Kong. Over 4 or 5 decades, I've seen the ups and downs and ups and downs. It's normal. So nothing to worry about. We just have to be confident.
Considering that Hong Kong serves as the primary gateway for the mainland's external opening and connecting to the international markets, what other measures can be taken to establish and maintain the security of Hong Kong's financial system, which we all think is crucial to safeguarding the city's status as an international financial center from potential suppression by certain Western countries against the Chinese mainland?
Thank you for the question, because in fact, that is my paper this year, because as we grow stronger, imminent threat and danger from the Western countries to further trying to suppress us. So I think we need to be prepared. And my paper is about, you know, creating a strong firewall, a financial firewall, in the event that certain financial sanctions should take place. Hopefully not. But I think we need to be prepared at all times. So I have a number of measures. There are certain things that we can do to better prepare ourselves if the imminent dangers happen.
Mr. Li, what unique advantages does Hong Kong still have in the future process of RMB internationalization, and what key roles can they play?
Hong Kong is very unique. Under the one country, two systems, where else in the world, we have the wonderful, great country of China, and also the free capital market, free flow of money and people, very much so. And all the other events that I mentioned earlier about education, creativities, and this Hong Kong is the crown jewel of China in the past, in the present, and in the future.
How does China remain positive economic growth despite the overall economic background globally is not very strong?
China is like a big, big container ship. It just keeps going. We are probably at the lower point at this point, but if you take a long-term trend, if you look at the long-term trend, it's still an upward trend. And as I said, you know, we have a very hardworking population, very good, strong work ethics, and we're 1.4 billion people all go the same direction, not internal fighting like some other countries. So I think in the report, we also emphasize on creating more internal demand. And we are, always, you know, going towards more and more in the One Belt, One Road. I think we have to face the reality, we will, regardless of the unnecessary and false media things about many things about China.
I am Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Australia has unveiled a plan to set aside $1.3 billion to bolster trade with Southeast Asian countries. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced the funding as ASEAN leaders meet in the city of Melbourne for a three-day special summit. Canberra has also announced more than $41 million in funding for maritime security, though it is unclear at this point which countries in Southeast Asia that the funding will go to. The special summit is marking 50 years since Australia became a dialogue partner for ASEAN. So joining us now on the line is Professor Chen Hong, Director of the Australian Studies Center with East China Normal University. So thank you very much for joining us today, Professor. Southeast Asia is widely seen as an emerging economic powerhouse, so it's not surprising that Australia wants to bolster trade with the region. In the meantime, some people also say this is a sign that Australia is looking to build economic ties outside its major trading partner, namely China. What is your take?
Well, first of all, with the emergence of the four tigers after the earlier economic miracle of the four dragons in the 1980s and 1990s, Southeast Asia has been an economic powerhouse. ASEAN is now the second largest two-way trade partner with Australia. And Australia has been adopting a policy of engagement with Asia, in particular to develop and enhance relations and cooperation with the Southeast Asia countries. So in other words, ASEAN has been on Australia's economic map for decades, and the two parties do have active, economic cooperation. I do agree that Australia is ready to expand its scope of economic relations to initiate and enhance more economic and trade engagement with ASEAN. However, as we need to be aware, during the past couple of years, Australia has been talking and making efforts to, seek their so-called new or alternative market to replace China. But all those attempts have proved to be of no avail. The China market, with its vastness and its velocity of development, is not so easily to be replaced. On the other hand, for most of the ASEAN countries, China is their largest trade partner in many areas, such as agriculture, fishery or seafood, in hospitality, such as tourism. Australia is a competitor for Southeast Asian countries rather than a partner. What China has been reiterating is a win-win scenario in which all parties could work together to promote mutual benefits, and tactics such as using one party to offset another is short-sighted, I believe, and simply not realistic in today's world.
So announcing its funding for maritime security, Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong suggested, quote, "What happens in the South China Sea, in the Taiwan Strait, in the Mekong subregion across the Indo-Pacific affects us all," unquote. And also last year, Australia and ASEAN held their first ever joint military exercises or drills. So, Professor Chen, what do you make of Penny Wong's comment I cited earlier, as well as Australia's perceived increasing interest in terms of the Southeast Asian security?
Well, one of Australia's most influential former prime ministers, Paul Keating, commented yesterday that Penny Wong was once again rattling the China box, and he warned that such instigations of tensions and conflicts are not helpful to their peace and stability in the region, nor is it conducive to their stabilization and improvement of Australia's relations with China. I think Penny Wong's remarks are indeed camouflage assaults on China's rightful activities in this region to safeguard its sovereignty and territorial integrity. They are more of an echo of the U.S. anti-China tactics. As you mentioned, last year, Australia held a first-ever military exercise with ASEAN, and we have been witnessing Australia's attempts to strengthen its military capacity you know, in particular, it's the capacity for long distance delivery of military forces. ASEAN has its avowed strategy to maintain peace, stability, and the prosperity of the region. The 10 countries of ASEAN have never been engaged in military conflicts among themselves, except for once in Cambodia in the late 1970s. And also, there have been no military confrontations between ASEAN and other countries or groups. The militarization of the Southeast Asian region is a serious step towards the prospective upheaval and disturbance in the region. As we were discussing, the Southeast Asian region has been an economic powerhouse in this world. And all countries, all stakeholders, including Australia, need to spare no effort to maintain the status quo characterized with stability and peace.
So, talking about security affairs, some particular ASEAN countries like Indonesia and Malaysia have actually raised this particular concern that Canberra's investment or its planned investment in a nuclear-powered submarine is potentially contributing to a nuclear arms race in Southeast Asia as well as the wider Asia Pacific region. But of course, in the meantime, we understand some other ASEAN countries do not necessarily share their view. But with regard to, say, countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, do you think these countries have a legitimate concern here?
Well, first of all, in 1995, ASEAN member states signed a treaty of Southeast Asian Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone, also known as the Bangkok Treaty. This treaty asserts a commitment to preserve the Southeast Asian region as a region free of nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction. And in 2022, in August, the ASEAN foreign ministers meeting reaffirmed this commitment. AUKUS, so-called Pillar 1, is to arm Australia with a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. And this violates the nuclear non-proliferation agreement and threatens the nuclear-free status in the Pacific region. Apart from the military dimension, the submarines could also bring about accidents involving nuclear leakage. Most of the ASEAN countries have long coastlines with marine economic interests. So obviously, Australia has been making excuses to whitewash this act, but risks and concerns are realistic. So I do think those ASEAN countries have the right, the legitimate right, to make their concerns heard and felt and demand changes to their proliferation of nuclear arms in this region.
So Australia's governing centre-left Labour Party has long been looking to forge closer ties with Southeast Asia because they recognize the geopolitical or the geographic proximity, rather, between Australia and ASEAN countries. On the other hand, Professor, to what extent do you think Australia's relationship with the region, I mean ASEAN countries in general, should be viewed through the lens of Canberra's close ties or close alliance with Washington?
Yes, we do have to note that in the recent years, there has been a tendency for Australia to pivot more to the ASEAN, as its regional group has been on the radar of the United States Indo-Pacific strategy. The United States has been trying to woo, the ASEAN countries to align with its strategy to counter the development of China. And allies and partners of the United States, such as Australia, has been enlisted. On Washington's chessboard, Australia has been assigned its role to serve as a political and even military, chess piece. And Australia is viewing the ASEAN countries as a possibility to convert it into instruments or even weaponry in their Indo-Pacific strategy. So I believe there is not only the economic considerations that we were discussing, but also the geostrategic planning that has been playing a role for Australia to strengthen its relationship with ASEAN. However, I do think ASEAN countries have their judicious assessment of their situation and are able to discern the real intentions behind the facade of Canberra's epoch of economic cooperation and aid programs, and to be able to make prudent decisions based on their political wisdom.
That was Professor Cheng Hong, Director of Australian Studies Center with East China Normal University. Thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to World Today. Stay tuned. You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. The German government has rejected allegations that Russia's leak of a conversation by high-ranking German military officers was an indication that Berlin is preparing for war against Russia. In the meantime, the government is also seeking to contain the domestic fallout from the leak, promising a quick investigation into how this conversation could be intercepted. The 38-minute recording features some German high-ranking German military officers discussing how Germany's Taurus long-range cruise missiles could be used by Kiev against Russian forces. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said a week ago that delivering these weapons to Ukraine was simply not an option for Berlin. So joining us now on the line is Dr. Alexei Muravyov, Associate Professor of National Security and Strategic Studies with Curtin University. Thank you very much for joining us. So, Professor, first of all, what is your main takeaway from this latest drama between Germany and Russia?
Well, I don't think there is any sort of extraordinary revelation there. I mean, the Russians have been arguing for a long time that elements of the Western military advisors were taking part in covert operations in Ukraine. The Russians have been arguing for a long time, for example, that certain weapon systems that have been supplied to Ukraine are actually crewed by Western specialists and not by the Ukrainians, whether it's the Patriot surface-to-air missiles or whether it's some high-precision, long-range missiles supplied by France and the UK. So in this sense, the conversation about the potential supply of the Taurus, which has been going on for way over a year, yeah, and the fact that senior German military officers were discussing contingency plans is not something really unusual, because obviously any country involved in the conflict, and Germany is involved in the conflict indirectly, obviously not directly, would be considering contingencies, because the West or those countries who support Ukraine, that support Ukraine militarily, make no secrets that they try to assist the Ukrainian military to the best capacity they can. So for them to discuss, for example, possible strike on the Crimea Bridge, how many missiles need to be deployed in order to destroy the core infrastructure target is not something unusual. So I think the most impact is actually not on Russia's relations with Germany, rather than the domestic situation inside Germany, and especially with regards to Chancellor Scholz's continuous refusal to take a next step in providing military assistance to Ukraine.
So based on what you have elaborated, Professor, do you think the outcome or the result of this investigation that German authorities have vowed to carry out is something people would care about?
Well, I'm not really sure what will come out of that. I don't think it will change the course for the Germans. I think it may create complications with respect to Germans' relations with other NATO allies, because obviously the conversation revealed what the Russians have been accusing the West of, that other foreign militaries have been actively involved in Ukraine, obviously not in great numbers, but in the capacity I described earlier. So I think Germany may be viewed as not as so much a trusted ally that kind of allowed to see this information slipping into the wrong hands. Plus, I think it's embarrassing for the German government to effectively confirm that the intercepted conversation was authentic, and secondly, that the Russians managed to get a hand of it, meaning that they have the capacity to tap into Germany's secured communications. Plus, obviously, it created problems because of internal investigation trying to work out who may have contributed to the release of this conversation, whether incidental or because of certain intent. So, again, I don't think it's going to have any dramatic turns apart from perhaps
further complicating the relationship between political forces inside Germany and perhaps between Berlin and other European capitals.
So, Professor Muraviov, in your observation of Germany, since this ongoing war in Ukraine broke out more than 2 years ago, do you think this idea that, oh, we don't want to get too much involved into this war, quote-unquote, is still a existent or is still a prevalent sentiment in Germany nowadays?
Well, obviously, the Germans have to consider the historical past. For their forces to appear on the Ukrainian ground would not really resonate really well and would certainly reinforce Russia's claims that they are fighting neo-Nazism, etc. You know, it's enough that the Russians were trying to capitalize on destroying German armor, drawing links between contemporary realities and what was happening about 80 years ago during the Second World War. So there is this element. Secondly, we need to remember that Germany will go through its own election cycle in 2025. And obviously, if current Chancellor Scholz will commit Germany to send its troops to Ukraine or escalate the situation by providing Ukraine with Taurus missiles, his re-election chances may actually look slim because this is not something that is widely supported inside Germany. So I think he may try to play also a pre-election card by trying to be non-committal and by that trying to present himself as some sort of a peacemaker because there's been a slight change of tone. And that's not because he's changing his stand on supporting Ukraine, but simply because he's trying to secure extra votes coming, including those who may be coming from the parties or from the segments of the electorate that want to find a political resolution to the war rather than continue to stimulate the war effort.
So, Professor, we still have about 2 minutes before we let you go. So the final question, some people's observation is that what this incident between Russia and Germany has really told us is that really the war in Ukraine has to a very large extent become a war of information. What is your observation?
The war in Ukraine is certainly one of the clear examples of the disinformation campaign, of the information war, of the propaganda war. And that's what makes this conflict really complex as well as hard to follow because there is so much that's been deliberately done through social media, through mass media in terms of propaganda, in terms of disinformation, in terms of ambiguity. So I think that does create additional confusion. It also can contribute to further escalation because trying to distinguish between reality and propaganda, between fake news and real news can also contribute to making an error of judgment, which can lead to fatal consequences. But again, because we're talking about conflict that is in progress, it's really difficult to make any definitive conclusion. So I think this war will be studied for many years to come because it's a sign of the return of an old-fashioned form of war fighting, something we thought we would never see after the end of the Cold War.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us and for your analysis. As always, that was Dr. Alexei Muraviov, Associate Professor of National Security and Strategic Studies with Curtin University in Australia. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. Tech giant Apple has been hit with a 1.8 billion euro or almost 2 billion US dollar fine by the European regulators. A European Union investigation found that the company restricted competition from music streaming services, violating the EU's antitrust rules. The fine is 4 times higher than previously expected, sending a strong message to some dominant technology companies. Apple has replied that it plans to appeal against this very decision. So for more, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Ina Tangen, senior fellow with the Taihe Institute.
Well, Apple was hit with an almost $2 billion US fine by the EU regulators. And the European Commission says the company wielded its dominance through its app store to the detriment of the music streaming rivals like Spotify. So tell us what specifically have happened for this case of Apple.
Okay. Well, Apple has its own ecosystem, which means that it controls it. It's not like Google in the sense that it has to work well with other partners. So Spotify complained that Apple was pushing its music service above Spotify's and manipulating the system. The EU agreed with them, and that's why they have a $2 billion fine. But that's just the beginning. The U.S. is looking at antitrust suits. There's also further action in the EU, first on this matter of Apple threatening to withdraw support for its web apps. And then second, a new piece of legislation that's coming in. On top of that, they abandoned their electric car project. And Apple Vision is suffering as people return the very expensive headsets because they don't know how to use them.
And the fine is quite high. The penalty is the third biggest antitrust fine the European Commission has imposed. So tell us more about it. Why does the EU want to do so right now?
Well, the EU is sending a very strong message. Now, you know, we have to remember that Apple is sitting on $167 billion. So if you do, you know, if you said, oh, here's a few hundred billion fine, and they have been fined in the past, it's not going to get their attention. A $2 billion fine catches Apple's attention, makes it clear that if this continues, it could even go higher. But it sends a very, very, very clear message that, you know, they're very, very serious about their regulations.
Mm. And the EU fine does not mean the end of Apple's regulatory battle. Around the world, more attempts are being made to, you know, put limits on tech company power. And some analysts say slowly Apple's closed ecosystem is being chipped away. So what do you make of that?
Well, you can say it's being chipped away or that its monopolistic powers have come to an end. And that's really what we're talking about. The U.S. Has had a 5-year investigation looking into Apple and what it calls monopolistic practices. It's expected to come out any day now in terms of an antitrust suit. And as I mentioned, the EU has a new set of guidelines coming into effect. And when they do, it's going to play havoc with Apple's closed ecosystem in terms of data sharing and what they can do. So, you know, Apple is really, really hitting the skids, both in terms of the regulatory environment, their closed ecosystem. And, you know, this is the way they've been making additional money. And then also on this hardware front where they do not have a new product which is ready to go to the market and make it. So this is going to reflect very poorly on Tim Cook. And you could see some movement in the executive suites there.
And as you mentioned, the EU's Digital Markets Act, or the DMA, will come into effect later this week. And companies that violate the new EU law will face fines of 10 or 20% of their global revenue. So what does it mean for Apple and other tech giants?
Not good. I mean, a lot of these tech giants were, you know, they're willing to pay $50, $20, $100 million because, you know, that's just the cost of business in their mind. They're making so much money on the other end, they don't really care. They make cosmetic changes, but they don't really change the way they're doing business. EU has decided to put an end to that. If you take away 10 to 20% of global revenue, that's not profits. That's revenue. Yes, that is going to do it. So what's going on here? Well, they're, you know, especially for Apple, they'll be barred from combining personal data across their different services, prohibited from using data they collected from third-party merchants to compete against them. And they'll have to allow other users to download apps from rival platforms, among other limits and obligations. So it's going to really change the way these ecosystems are used. And this will also affect Google.
And in the U.S., Apple's largest market, the company is still under investigation by the Justice Department. So could you tell us more on that?
Yeah, specifically, investigators have examined how the Apple Watch works better with the iPhone than other brands, and, you know, and how Apple locks competition out of its messaging services. They've been looking at Apple's payment systems for the iPhone, which blocks other financial firms from offering similar services. So this is once again coming back to this closed ecosystem that Apple has used to, in essence, say, well, if you use the iPhone, you have to go through us, and if you go through us, you're going to most likely use our products because the other ones don't work as well, or we just kind of shut them out.
Mm. And what do you think is Apple's main revenue sources right now? And what is its next focus?
In 2023, Apple generated $383 billion in revenue. About 52% came from iPhone sales. Apple service is a second with about 22%. So, you know, that's about 74%. The rest is spread, you know, among iPads and MacBooks, etc. And then home and wearables division, which had been going very well. You know, Apple Watch was quite the thing for some time, but it actually declined 3.6% in 2023. So it's not where it's been. Apple Music has 88 million subscribers. Obviously, that's you know, very lucrative. And, you know, but taking away the cars and also this issue about Apple Vision, these goggles, artificial reality goggles, which were supposed to take the world by storm, were very expensive. And even the people who are early adopters said, we don't understand what to do with them, and they are returning them. So not the best start for that.
So why is it smartphone revenue slowing?
Well, it's basically reached a saturation point. Worldwide, you have people still buying Apple because it's a status symbol. They're dominating markets. For instance, in China, they have a 24% of the market. There's only so far you can go with one market, and then you need new things to do it. There was hope that the car would do it, that the augmented reality goggles would do it. Obviously, wearables were hot for a moment, but they just haven't come up with that, you know, unique product. It's not like the old days under, you know, the Steve Jobs. It's just they're struggling to find the next thing.
Ina Tangen, senior fellow with the Taihe Institute, talking to my colleague Zhao Yang. Unfortunately, that's all the time for this edition of World Today. A recap of today's headline news. Chinese officials defend a realistic GDP target while at the same time vowing to crack down upon financial markets' irregularities. Germany-Russia spar over a leaked audio on missiles for Ukraine. Apple gets fined nearly $2 billion by the EU for hindering music streaming competition. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.